This week, we're in the Mathematical Institute in Oxford for episode 19, season 2 of Travels Through Time. I'm Violet Moller, and this week we're visiting Paris in the year 1831 to meet an irascible young mathematician called Évariste Galois. Our guide on this trip to the 19th century is Marcus de Sautoy, who is Professor of Mathematics at Oxford University and Simony Professor for the Public Understanding of Science. So he's one of those rare creatures who is both a brilliant mathematician and a talented writer and communicator of ideas. Marcus's passion for numbers and their history has resulted in several best-selling books, and his most recent one, called The Creativity Code, explores the question of whether computers will ever be able to be truly creative. But today, we are going to talk about Évariste Galois, whom Marcus wrote about in his book Finding Moonshine, and said of him that this young revolutionary was the first to articulate a language that I speak every day of my working life. Galois' exceptional creativity burnt bright, but his life was turbulent and very short. He was dead by the age of 20, after being sucked into the bloody whirlpool of French revolutionary politics and beleaguered by personal misfortune and trauma. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Marcus de Sautoy. It's great to have you on. Before we go to our year, which is 1831, I'd like to ask you a bit about writing and being a mathematician, because you are, of course, the Simony Professor for the Public Understanding of Science. Is that the right title?
That's correct, yes.
And I just wanted to ask you about how you combine your two jobs. You've written lots of very successful books.
Yes, well, that's quite a surprise to me and probably a surprise to my English teachers at school, because I was always a little bit rubbish at writing. I can't spell very well. And somehow mathematics is where I sort of found my niche. I kind of enjoyed mathematics because you always knew when you got the right answer. And when you're writing an essay in history or in English, you know, it's very much open to interpretation, and one teacher might like what you're doing, the other not. So it was quite a surprise to start using this kind of muscle of writing, and it took me some time to sort of get it going. But eventually it's sort of, I was enjoying using sort of the spoken word to tell mathematical stories. And it culminated in writing my first book, The Music of the Primes, which was a kind of ultra marathon. I mean, it was a real slog to sort of tell that story. And it's interesting because the original version of that story, I wrote in a very mathematical way. It was a very mathematically led narrative. And my editor at Fourth Estate was a historian. And he said, look, you're going to get this narrative, but you're jumping all over the place. And readers are just not going to understand how you've chosen this sort of course through your material. And he said, look, I would suggest using a more historical narrative, which is one that people will be much more comfortable with.
So more chronological rather than...
Yes, yes. So, and actually it made some sense because, you know, ideas grow out of previous ideas, and it has a natural narrative to it, which is historical. And so that really helped in the writing. I mean, I always wanted to bring out the characters behind the mathematics, because I think many people think mathematics is sort of, you know, handed down from the sky somehow. It's you know, they don't realize that it's created. There are moments when mathematics comes into fruition, and that's,
you know, it also stops it being dry, doesn't it? It stops it just being a sort of series of
well
theories.
We do have quite a lot of interesting characters,
exactly,
in our story,
yes,
as we're about to
as
find
we're
out,
find out.
It's interesting because, you know, my recent book is about the creativity code, and I've been really exploring, you know, what are the key elements that lead to creative acts. And I think very often it's about mixing disciplines. So that's what I do with my PhD students. I really encourage
fusion.
Them to... Fusion. Yeah, exactly. You will go into a lecture about something completely different, but you'll suddenly see some patterns there that apply to what you're doing. So
yeah, but
so
that can be difficult at universities, can't it? Because universities are very divided up into the separate disciplines.
Yes, but I think that's why I love Oxford, because, you know, we're sitting here actually in the Mathematical Institute. So this is a institute dedicated to mathematics. Yet I will also spend the day in New College, which is a place which brings people from many different disciplines together. And so there I will have conversations which really break me out of my silo. I remember sitting next to the English tutor. I've been given this challenge about maths and Shakespeare. You know, what are the connections? Yeah, exactly. That's where I went, wow. And then I started asking him, are there connections? And he started reeling off all of these amazing facts about whenever Shakespeare is talking about magic, it's always 7 syllables, not 10 syllables. At the end of The Tempest, Ferdinand and Miranda play a game of chess. And if you look at that passage where they're talking, it's laid out the syllables of a chessboard, 8 by 8. So these conversations are really important to me in actually...
Yeah, cross-fertilisation.
Yeah, I think it's what Oxford does actually very well.
Yeah. So as you said, your most recent book, The Creativity Code, is all about creativity and whether computers will ever be able to be truly creative like human beings. And I was very interested in the bit at the beginning. You were talking about Margaret Bowden and the 3 types of creativity. And I found that very fascinating. Will you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. I mean, I've been really fascinated with this kind of current surge in the development of artificial intelligence about how far can it go. And, you know, there've been some really interesting creative acts by code over the last few years, which is what sort of prompted the writing of this book. But I was on a committee with Margaret Bowden at the Royal Society where we were forward scoping the impact of this new technology. And she's been thinking for a while about creativity and AI. And she has 3 different versions of creativity, which I think are really helpful to try and sort of see which ones might AI be successful at. So one of them is called exploratory creativity, which is about taking the rules of the game and kind of pushing them to the extreme. So, for example, I would say Bach is a little bit like that because he takes the kind of musical structures of the day, but just
changes them.
Yes, but kind of explores them to the absolute limit until it kind of breaks and you get Mozart and Beethoven and a very different sort of music appearing. Yeah. Then there's this kind of combinational creativity, which is actually like this idea of fusion, taking ideas from one area and seeing how they could help you to be creative in another area. So, you know, fusion cooking is a little bit like that. So take the ingredients of Asia, but apply the methodology of French cuisine to it. And then the 3rd sort of creativity, which I think is the kind of exciting one and the really challenging
one,
the rare one, is transformational creativity, where something seems to come out of nowhere, where the rules are broken and you get a kind of real phase change. So atonal music, for example, Schoenberg's idea of actually we don't have to work within a tonal structure, and that just unleashes something new. Or Picasso and Cubism and that whole change. I mean, it's very interesting that beginning of the 20th century, you just see in so many disciplines.
Yeah, sort of physics, paradigm change.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that's the sort of thing where you think, surely AI couldn't be successful there because it's got to work within a system.
Yeah.
But I actually challenge that and say, well, you know, there is a rule that we apply, which is to break rules.
Yes.
So why couldn't you get an AI to ask to break the rules of the system that it's working in? And then it might see that there are interesting things which emerge from that. So
yeah.
I think even that one, which people hopefully think, oh, that's uniquely human because it's sort of coming from nowhere. Actually, I think it does come from somewhere. These phase changes do not appear from nowhere.
No. And would you say that the man we're going to talk about today is called Évariste?
Yes, Évariste Galois.
From what I've read about him, I would say he would fall into that last sort of magical category of...
Yes, you see, I think this is really interesting. So he causes, you know, why he's one of my mathematical heroes, because he did create a completely new language for helping to understand one of the fundamental subjects of science and mathematics, which is symmetry. So you can really see a sort of phase change at that point. It took actually some time for mathematicians to realize what he'd done.
So let's find out a bit about Galois' background. Can you tell us about his education? I read a very funny quote from one of his teachers, which I'll just read and then you can fill us in. There is nothing in his work except strange fantasies and negligence. He always does what he should not do. He gets worse every day. He has gone from one punishment to another. His ambition, his frequently ostentatious originality, his bizarre character keep him isolated from his schoolfellows.
It's interesting because I suppose with our modern day perspective, you might wonder whether this character perhaps suffered a little bit of Asperger's.
Yes,
or autism.
I thought of that, yeah.
I mean, certainly he just doesn't understand how other people work.
Yeah.
And this is going to get him into awful trouble.
Well, we see later, don't we?
Exactly. So he does fall in love with mathematics at school because of a book that he discovers, and that probably is... It's interesting because I think I recognise this in myself, that when I fell in love with mathematics, I saw this as a very safe space to escape into where I understood how things worked and the certainty that that gives you. It's a kind of playground where, you know, you don't need other people necessarily to...
and you don't have to worry about other people's emotions or
exactly.
reactions.
So I suspect that, you know, this book that he found sort of sparked this interest, and he enjoyed spending time on his own in this world.
So Galois grows up in this small French town near Paris and goes to the local school. And then his parents, I believe, send him to Paris to the lycée. And I think he's 12 at this time. And this is quite, I imagine, quite a moment in his life. You know, he's been sent away from home.
Well, he is very close, especially to his father. And I think that really was very unsettling, to be sent to, you know, a school with a lot of discipline, you know, on his own at the age of 12, when he loved his kind of family environment. So I think that was very unsettling.
And the school sounded quite grim. And I think that you wrote something about the children would lie in bed at night and be nibbled by rats.
Yeah, I mean, what a terrible place to have to go to after having, you know, been in the comfort of your family home.
Yeah.
When he finds a book of mathematics, that is his kind of escape door.
Yeah.
It's his safe place, exactly.
And then he decides he wants to get into this very prestigious school, and he goes off and takes the exam without even telling his parents, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I think he's so confident in his own abilities, especially in mathematics. I think, I mean, even his teachers at school did recognise that the one thing he was quite good at was maths. But he goes off, he's so confident that he's going to succeed at this. But he fails this exam, and that's quite devastating for him. He sort of doesn't understand why they don't understand his great abilities. So actually he decides to take a different course, and he's actually at this point started to think about one of the great unsolved problems at the time, which is about solving equations.
Okay, can you explain this?
Yeah.
I'm not going to try and explain this.
Fair enough. So listeners might remember from school probably learning equation for solving something called a quadratic equation, which is about squared plus... Yeah, so you learn this formula which gives you the numbers which will make this equation equal to zero. And so this was discovered by the ancient Babylonians. And so we have understood sort of square equations for thousands of years. Then the question is, well, is there a formula which will solve slightly more complicated equations, maybe with an x cubed in? And this indeed was discovered, a formula which would help you to solve those. And the next one up, x to the fourth. And the challenge in this period, when Galois beginning to fall in love with mathematics, is can you come up with a formula which will give you the solutions, will solve the equation where you've got an x to the 5? It's called a quintic equation. And it turns out that there isn't any formula. That it's really weird. You've got a formula for quadratic, cubic, quartic, but at this point, suddenly, a general formula doesn't exist. And that's actually really difficult to prove mathematically. It's quite easy to find something which makes something work, but to show you'll never be able to find something requires a completely different mindset. So this is what Galois is working on, and he finds some way to understand why such an equation could never exist. And this has actually been a challenge that Parisian mathematicians have been thinking about for a while. So he thinks, wow, I've made a breakthrough on one of the great unsolved problems of the day. I'm going to write this up, submit this to the academy, and the mathematicians in Paris will recognize the genius that's sitting here.
Yeah.
And, you know, those examiners at the Polytechnique will realize what a big mistake they make. And so he delivers at the age of 17, in spring 1829, he takes this manuscript to the academy, leaves it with them, and just sits back and waits for, you know, the applause.
The adoration, yeah.
Yeah, which doesn't happen.
No, what happened?
So there's a mathematician there, Cauchy, who takes this manuscript and he actually realizes, there's some interesting ideas there. And he promises to give a report slightly later on in the year about this manuscript. But then that's the last we hear about it. And this manuscript gets lost. And Galois is like, well, what's happened to it? And nobody knows anything about this. He thinks, okay, then he goes back to the Ecole Polytechnique and he says, okay, I'm going to apply there again. You know, surely this time I can persuade the examiners. And the exam ends in him throwing chalk at the examiners and frustrated at the fact that these examiners seem so stupid that they don't understand his ideas.
Yeah, again, there's the sort of problem of being able
he's locked in his own mind. He doesn't understand why people don't understand these new ideas. And this is a really interesting phenomenon because I've found this on my own mathematics. When you come up with a completely new way of looking at something, the challenge of finding the right language to bring that idea alive in somebody else's mind is really...
Well, the communication that we were talking about earlier.
So and so this is why I think, actually, a dominant theme in the book Finding Moonshine that I wrote about this whole story is the idea of language and the power of language to bring alive new ideas. And Galois here just is finding it really difficult to articulate what's going on inside his head. And so, and it's fascinating that I've seen some of the manuscripts that Galois wrote. They are a complete mess of symbols and kind of scribbles. And it's no wonder the Ecole Polytechnique examiners and the academicians didn't understand what he was doing. Because he's just finding it really difficult to get the ideas out of his head and onto the page or the blackboard or even into words so that somebody else can understand it.
Galois' life was going on with the backdrop of the political situation in France at that time, which was extremely tumultuous. Can you just tell us a little bit about the next stage of his story and how that is very much affected by the political situation?
The rejection by the academic establishment of his mathematical ideas, I think, is what drove him to a very hardcore revolutionary movement in Paris. So, he fails his exam again at the Ecole Polytechnique. He has to go to a kind of what he regards as a second grade school preparing teachers. He's deeply frustrated. He submits another manuscript again to the academy, which a new academician, Fourier, is meant to look at. Fourier unfortunately dies, the second manuscript gets lost.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
It is almost unbelievable how many times this poor kid just gets rejected, the manuscripts are getting lost. And when his father commits suicide because of pressure by the ultras at his hometown, and this is another kind of just bomb that goes off in Galois' life. So I think you're absolutely ripe for this kid exploding. So we have the three glorious days, the revolution, 26th of July, 1830, King Charles X dissolves parliament and this causes this revolution. This is the moment where he can make
his mind. He's been waiting for.
But he's locked in his school. The headmaster doesn't let the students out. He tries to climb the walls. He just can't join this revolution. He's frustrated and he's unable to take part in this, the three glorious days. So Galois had his maths rejected, everything rejected. He joins this hardcore anarchic National Guard, which is, these are the hardcore revolutionaries. So here we have, this student who's made this major breakthrough. Nobody understands it. He feels so frustrated. He's ready for revolution.
Yeah. And now that takes us to our first scene, which is May the 9th, 1831. Describe, where are we? What are we doing? What are we watching happen?
This is a dinner that is held to celebrate the fact that some members of the National Guard who were arrested, I think about 19 of them, get released. And this is a great success for the revolutionary group. And they celebrate 200 revolutionaries come together to celebrate at this dinner. And the dinner gets more and more raucous. And Galois is sitting there. And I think probably he can't take his drink very well.
Yeah,
I think
but there are several. He's still very young. How old is he? 18, 19, 20 by now?
Yes, I have to do some maths to work that out. we're talking 1831, so he's probably 19.
Okay.
Probably 19 or 18.
And but the champagne is flowing.
The champagne is flowing, and suddenly Galois gets up onto the table, puts his glass in the air for a toast to Louis Philippe. And then suddenly the revolutionaries see that in his other hand, he's holding a dagger. And they realise that this isn't...
He's not really toasting the health of the king.
Not toasting the health of the king. He's toasting, the death, probably, of the king. So suddenly the party erupts from this toast and things go completely wild. And some of the more moderate members of the party realise they need to escape because this is, really going to kick off. I think Victor Hugo is actually there and he writes about, suddenly the party turned nasty and I escaped quickly out the back. And sure enough, Galois gets arrested from this dinner for having toasted the death of the king. So this is, his first kind of bold revolutionary statement, which ends up with him in prison. What's interesting is he manages to get off this charge. So his lawyer comes up with a rather clever way. Although there was a lot of noise, what was missed was Galois saying to Louis-Philippe, if he turned traitor. So he wasn't actually saying the death. He was just saying, look, provided he stays okay, we're all right. But if he turns traitor, then, perhaps we should regard him
as... And that must say quite a lot about the sort of the state of France at that time. Because, normally if you even mentioned anything that was even vaguely treasonous in a, yes, monarchy, then you were literally sort of straight to the Tower of London, off with your head.
I'm actually really surprised he managed to get off a technicality.
But maybe the judge had Republican sympathies.
Seeing this... young kid realizing that he's a young kid and perhaps needs another chance, and so he's let off, but he doesn't learn.
So there's a real sense, isn't there, that he's this incredibly reckless, angry young man who's just sort of careering off course in his life with very, very good reason. But, he's being carried along by the disappointments and the tragedies of his own personal life. But then he's being carried along in the current of the much, much bigger flow of French history, which is, of course, only going to get more dramatic as the next years go by. Then we fast forward to October the 23rd. Please, can you take us to your second scene? Where are we going? Who are we watching?
Yes. So this is my second date, which is the date that actually he does get thrown in prison because he hasn't learnt. He's appeared at a demonstration on Bastille Day in the band uniform of the National Guard. This already was what put the original prisoners in prison when they had this party to celebrate the release. Now it's just not acceptable. He gets picked up again. He doesn't get a second chance this time. And he's put in this pretty gruesome prison with a lot of his own fellow revolutionaries. Now, what's intriguing is that he's actually submitted during this year a third manuscript to the Academy, which actually is sitting with another mathematician, Poisson, this time. Poisson, it seems like actually Poisson may have come along to some lectures that Galois was giving in a bookshop. They were meant to be revolutionary lectures, but he actually talked about mathematics, and I think the revolutionary was sitting there
wondering what
is he going on. But Poisson apparently attended this bookshop, heard a few of the lectures, and realised, oh, there's some very interesting ideas here. And it seems like he encouraged Galois to submit a third manuscript.
Well, that's impressive that he went ahead and did that after his two disappointments.
Exactly. So when he's in prison, he's got quite a lot of time on his hands. He's there for 6 months, sitting with a lot of his fellow revolutionaries. So what's he going to do? He realises, this is quite a good time actually to try and formulate my ideas more clearly. So he sits with this manuscript, a copy of the manuscript that he submitted, and he tries to write more clearly the ideas that he's been having. And he's encouraged by another fellow academic who's in the prison with him. And I think this is really fascinating because time and again, there are examples in the history of mathematics where being stuck in prison turns out to be a wonderful place to do mathematics.
Why do you think that is?
I think partly because you're after some way of escaping. Here you are stuck inside the confines of it. There are no distractions for a start. There's nothing else to do, exactly. And you also want somewhere, for mathematicians, always this mathematical world, universe, is a place to escape in your mind and you're free. So there's a very interesting example in the 20th century of one of my other mathematical heroes, André Weil, who's actually picked up for, he says he's not going to serve in the French army in the Second World War. He gets put in prison. He then makes one of the great breakthroughs on something called the Riemann hypothesis for function fields. And actually he writes to his friends, you know, maybe I need to spend more time in prison. You know, this is the place that I come up with such great ideas. And there's another guy, Sophist Lee, who gets picked up at the end of the 19th century. He's walking across the mountains in Europe. It starts raining and he puts all of his clothes in his bag and he's stark naked walking across the landscape, gets picked up.
Gets arrested for being walking around naked.
Well, he gets arrested because they think this is a weirdo and a spy, and sure enough they find all of this mathematics in his rucksack.
Yeah.
This is, it's all in code. Yeah. He gets put in prison and again comes up with something called Lie groups, which emerges out of the work that Galois does. Again, you know, a third person who makes breakthroughs.
I think I can see a book forming of brilliant masterpieces that were written in prison.
Well, of course, you know, it's not just mathematics.
No, Boethius wrote The Consolation of Philosophy when he was in prison. Yeah, but brilliant. And that makes me think about something you wrote about in The Creativity Code, which was this whole idea of how we can push beyond the boundaries of the human mind. And I think you told a story of a Russian maths professor who used Class A drugs to open his...
And one of my modern-day heroes, Vladimir Voivodsky. I was quite surprised when I talked to him, came and visited us here in Oxford, explained these amazing breakthroughs he made, which were real transformative creativity. They were producing a new language. I mean, that's similar in a way to Galois, that Galois' work came up with a language that enabled us to talk about symmetry for the first time. This is really the heritage of Galois' work. Vladimir Voivodsky comes up with a new sort of language to talk about kind of structures that we were having a lot of difficulty with. And it transpires that he uses a lot of drugs in order to find that kind of zone to make his kind of breakthroughs. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. And of course, if you take drugs, you might well end up in prison anyway. So
that's true. No, he managed to keep out of prison. So.
Right, so he writes this manuscript when he's in the prison, and then what happens? So how long is he in prison for? He gets out of prison and then he submits it, or how does it work?
Well, no, he doesn't get the chance to really resubmit this rewriting of his ideas. Cholera breaks out, and actually the prisoners have to get moved to a hospital. So he spends the last period of his incarceration in this hospital, where actually he meets a woman, and it seems like he falls in love, Stephanie. Yeah. This is... you know, I think a first for him, as far as we can see, that, you know, love is in the air. And this could be the cause of the tragedy that eventually happens and is the, you know, the date
our
I'm going to choose.
Scene.
My third final scene. So, you know, he eventually is released from prison about 6 months later. He's got this new manuscript, but he...
And does it survive, that manuscript?
Well, it's interesting. It does survive, this manuscript. It doesn't get submitted, but he's got a lot going on. He's just been released from prison. He's got this kind of new love. There's still revolutionary politics. He wants to make an impact on the revolution. And then he gets into an argument with one of his fellow revolutionaries. Now, this is what we're not quite clear about, because this argument ends with a duel.
Right.
He's challenged to a duel, and this is the third date that I've chosen.
So now this is scene three,
May 30th,
1832. Your third scene, where are we? What's happened to Galois?
May 30th, 1832 is the day when Galois has to meet his destiny at this duel. Now, it's not quite clear, and this is what's kind of fascinating about this story, and actually it's why I would love to go back to this year to find out really what the answer was, because there are three theories about what caused this duel. The first one is that it's actually over this woman, Stephanie. Both of these revolutionaries, Galois and his friend, have fallen in love with this woman, and they challenge each other to a duel to decide who's going to get the woman.
That was quite traditional in those days, wasn't it?
I guess it probably was, yeah. The second idea is that actually the whole thing is manufactured by the establishment, that the establishment wants some way to get rid of this troublesome revolutionary. And in fact, the whole thing is staged, and that in fact, it's a way of getting rid of this guy who's becoming a thorn in their side.
Yeah.
The third theory is even more intriguing, which is Galois is just... at his end, and he just can't go on, and you know, his father commits suicide.
Yeah.
Then in some sense he says, I've had enough,
I can't,
and I'm going to sacrifice myself for the revolution, and I am going to die in a duel, and you're going to use my burial and my death as the spark for a new revolution. So fascinating. Third theory is he
And so the reason we don't know what happened, because all we know is that on the early morning of this day, a peasant is walking on their way to market and they find Galois sort of crawling along the ground beside a pond, bleeding
yes.
to death.
Yes, yeah, right. Exactly. So they find somebody who's clearly been shot in this dueling wound. He gets taken to the local hospital, the Cochin Hospital, where he dies next day in the arms of his brother Alfred. And the last words he says is, "Alfred, I need all the courage I can muster to die at the age of 20. I mean, it's so tragic.
It's so moving, isn't it?
But what's really fascinating is that we know that he spent the whole of the previous night up to that duel writing away his mathematical ideas. He knew he probably was going to die in this duel.
Do you think?
I think he knew that he was going to die, because he spends the whole night trying to get this manuscript, you know, making it clear. He's going to leave it for his friend Chevalier. He leaves it on his desk. So he's been up all night. I think it's the reason he was such a bad shot that morning is that, you know, he spent the whole night doing mathematics. He might have survived if he said, okay, I'm going to do this duel on a, you know, good night's sleep. So interesting, you know, he dies a day later at this duel, and his friend Chevalier comes and finds this manuscript on the desk, and he feels it's behoven on him to continue the ideas that, you know, nobody's recognised what they
And is he
are.
Also a mathematician?
He is a mathematician, but I don't think he's
not the
truly
same level.
So he has to find somebody who's going to really understand what's going on. And that's what's fascinating, you know, from this day on, you know, it takes several decades for Galois' ideas to fully land and for people to recognise the massive breakthrough he's made. Not just on showing that this quintic equation doesn't have solutions, they realise that he's done something so much more. He's created a new language, a kind of algebraic language, to talk about the very slippery concept of symmetry. Symmetry is interesting because it's something very geometric. You know, we think of reflectional symmetry, rotational symmetry, but it turns out there are many other sorts of symmetries, and it's Galois' language that he produced to solve this problem that eventually becomes this thing which is called group theory.
Yes.
It's the language that I use as a practicing mathematician every day of my life, and it had its beginnings in that work that Galois did at school that nobody
amazing.
Understood at the time.
So it was really profound, his influence.
Totally. I mean, we teach our undergraduates here the ideas that Galois came up with. There's something called group theory, which also connects to something which we call Galois theory.
I'm glad he's got one name.
He has got his name definitely on a whole course here that undergraduates learn. And this language really gives us the tools to ultimately come up, and this is where I came in as a research mathematician, in the mid-1980s, we finally come up with a kind of a periodic table of symmetry. So the periodic table in chemistry is kind of the building blocks, the atoms from which we make molecules, hydrogen and oxygen. Galois' language that he developed and that we understood from that manuscript he left after that duel gives us the language to be able to see that symmetry too can be broken down into indivisible symmetries, and we eventually arrived at a kind of periodic table, a list of these indivisible symmetries in the mid-1980s. And that's actually when I became a research mathematician. And what I've been doing in my own research is, well, if these are the atoms, what are the molecules that you can make? What are the symmetrical objects?
Yeah.
So for me, I use Galois' language to kind of build new symmetries. Not symmetries you can see in three dimensions. These are symmetries in very high dimensional space. And I need to use Galois' language for me to be able to make these shapes and make the kind of creative moves of making new symmetries.
Oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful. So that was his extremely important mathematical legacy. Can you just talk a little bit about what happened at his funeral? Did his death have, if he had intended that his death would then spark, was his wish fulfilled?
So his mates actually think this will be a good reason to spark a revolution. Whether that was Galois' idea or not, who knows? But certainly they thought, let's use his funeral as a reason, you know, this young revolutionary killed. And then suddenly this big general dies and they realize, oh no, this is much more significant kind of funeral that's coming up. And so they abandon poor Galois' funeral as the spark for the new revolution. And they try to use this general's funeral some days later as the spark. So if Galois did sacrifice himself, it was in vain because they used somebody else's death as the attempt to get revolutionary. He's eventually buried in a kind of pauper's grave. And
have you been, can you visit it? Does anyone know
where it's interesting. I haven't been I've worked quite a lot at the École Polytechnique in Paris. That's, I have a research mathematician that I work with there, François Lazur, in the École Normale. And so I've sort of spent a lot of time in the area where he was.
And is he very much recognised now by the French establishment as being an extremely important...
Yeah, he is. I mean, we all recognise.
So he has finally been accepted into the École Polytechnique.
I think he is celebrated in France and across the world for the breakthroughs he made. And I think, you know, Poisson, who is taking this third manuscript, eventually does realise that, and he sends, I think, Galois notes whilst he's in prison, sort of encouraging him. I think that's part of his kind of stimulus for continuing to work on this. But honestly, it does take several decades to truly understand the breakthrough that he made.
And do you think that, because one question I wanted to ask you was about how, in this period, how scientific ideas are transmitted between different places and, you know, are people sort of writing letters? Is there a sort of republic of mathematics, like there was a republic of letters? How does that work? There's probably journals.
You've already got journals in place. And so the Academy would have had their own journal. I mean, you've got the academies, you've got the journals. The other very interesting ingredient you've got here for scientific dissemination and creativity is prizes. The Academy had this initiative to offer prizes sometimes for very specific problems. There's actually a very interesting French mathematician at the time that Galois is around, Sophie Germain, who has to pretend to be a man, actually, to get accepted right at the beginning.
Is she the one that Galois was very rude to?
Yes, exactly. So she's in the Academy, and she's quite sympathetic to Galois, but, you know, he's very rude to her and, you know, really unnecessary. This just reveals his inability to play the game, in a way. But she, for example, submits she becomes quite famous because of solutions she submitted to one of the prizes that the Academy was offering to understand something called Chladni plates. I think these prizes were quite important ways to stimulate new mathematics, because you would say, you know, we've got this problem about quintic equations. Is there a formula which will solve them, or can you prove there isn't?
So is that sort of early scientific funding?
Yes, I think it's, I don't know whether you actually got, I mean, you won a prize, so you did get some money if your prize.
But it was a way of sort of focusing scientific endeavour and saying, we need to find this out.
Yes, so the Academy were quite influential in steering mathematicians towards problems that they felt were significant. But I think the journals at this stage are already one of the major places that people are trying to disseminate their work.
And having their sort of discussions and communicating with one another.
Yes. But I think one of the fascinating things is that mathematics should be able to speak for itself. So, and you see some interesting examples where people are coming from nowhere. People like Galois, you know, this kid at school. If he'd been able to articulate more clearly his ideas, I think that the Academy would have been able to recognise the breakthrough.
But also if the Academy had been more receptive, I mean, and hadn't lost his manuscripts. I mean, you know,
I think there was some...
They didn't cover themselves in glory.
They didn't. There were some bad sort of coincidences. You know, Fourier dies having been given this manuscript, the second manuscript to examine. It's just unfortunate. It gets lost, after that death. I think it's interesting, this character Cauchy, who is the first person to receive the manuscript, there's a lot of debate about whether, this was a rather evil character who was trying to steal Galois' ideas and so didn't actually... Or there's a suggestion that Cauchy actually encouraged Galois to submit a second manuscript for one of these prizes. And so, you know, maybe he was the good guy in this story, saying, look, you've got some great things, do a second, more clear manuscript, and put it into this prize, and then it has to be examined. So it's interesting, because Cauchy is very ancien régime. He's against the revolution. So again, you know, is there politics going on here?
I mean, it would have. I mean, you can't go through a period in history like they did at the end of the 18th century and not. I mean, if you look at how Brexit affects all of us, you know, and that pales to insignificance compared to what happened with the Reign of Terror, and that, you know, I mean, everyone would have had a point of view. Everyone would have had a standpoint, and it must have affected the whole structure of society, I think.
Yes, exactly. And you've got things like Cauchy actually has to flee Paris because, you know, as the revolution...
Yes,
take hold.
Leaving his wife and his children behind.
Yes. So if he was somebody who was beginning to understand Galois' work, you know, he was moved off the scene because of this politics. So, I mean, it's such a fascinating and such a tragic story for this guy to have made all these breakthroughs so early at school to die at the age of 20.
I know, and imagine if he lived till he was 80. I mean, what he could have come up with. I mean, who knows?
I think that's why I would love to have gone back and said, don't go to that duel. You know, it's going to end in tears. You're going to let me kind
I don't
of
think
smuggle
you could have
your
stopped
way.
Him. I think he was.
I don't think so.
He was on a downward spiral and there was no stopping him, I think. So there's just one final question which I have to ask, which is, if you could bring an item from that year back with you, what would it be?
It would be one of those pages that Galois scribbled on, because it's very interesting. When I first wrote my first book, The Music of the Primes, and I did a lot of historical sort of digging around, and I went to Göttingen to see some of the manuscripts that the hero of that book, Bernhard Riemann, had written, I had a strange moving experience sitting in front of the mathematics that this person had scribbled on a page. And I was not expecting that, because...
But it's that feeling that they touch this piece of paper.
They touch this piece of paper, the ink on the page.
Manuscripts are... Until you've actually sat with them, you can't...
understand it until exactly that. So
it's magical.
I suddenly understand why historians
it's
kind
because
of
the,
enjoy...
the time, you know, the years in between just kind of get telescoped and you're suddenly there. It's like you're there sitting next to them.
I think. And it is that connection. Because, you know, I still... It's interesting. You think, well, surely a modern mathematician... like you, Marcus, you must be using a computer all the time and, you know, AI will be helping you to make new discoveries. No, my palette of choice is a yellow legal notepad with an ink pen, and I'm doing exactly the same thing as Galois is doing, scribbling things. It looks a complete mess. It's all over the place.
And isn't that what is unique about mathematics compared to all the other sciences? Because all the other sciences rely on technology in order to... I mean, if you think of astronomy, medicine, you know, the list goes on and on and on. Archaeology, even
the wonderful thing is that I am very cheap to fund, because I don't need any of this technology. All I need is
you could make do with a pencil. Need the ink
pencil. I probably need the paper, and what's quite useful is a waste paper bin as well.
But this might change in the future, because as you talk about in the creativity code, mathematicians now, you know, do use computers to do a lot of the sort of calculating.
Yes,
to save
but
time.
I think not only that, you see. I think this is why I wrote this new book, The Creativity Code, because I think there's more than just calculating going on. I mean, surely, you know, computers for years have been able to calculate faster than I can. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, mathematics is so much more than just calculation. In fact, I'm useless at calculation. Galois would never have done any calculations. It was all kind of symbolic manipulation and ideas. But what I think is changing now is that I think this computer is beginning to think in really interesting new ways. So it's not just doing calculations. It's understanding how to connect things together in interesting new ways. So I think there is a really interesting future ahead, which is a collaboration between the mathematician and
the machine.
You see, mathematics for me, if I had to define it, it's about pattern searching. And we have amazing brains that have evolved to find out patterns. But what's fascinating is this new artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning, is also beginning to get very good at sniffing out patterns. And I think that combined, we might be able to make breakthroughs on, you know, the great unsolved problems that still exist today, that, you know, the problems that Galois would have enjoyed working on that we haven't made, you know, able to crack. Perhaps, you know, I have a conjecture that I'm working on, which is about symmetrical objects. And I've been working on it for probably 20 years now. Well, I don't know how to make that breakthrough. You know, it relies on Galois' language. But the interesting thing is, will I need to use these new tools to make that breakthrough? Or is it still something I'll be able to do on my yellow legal pads and ink paper? And that's how to make those breakthroughs.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, good luck with that breakthrough. I hope it comes.
Thank you.
And thank you so much. I've really loved talking to you. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Artemis, and that was Violet Moller talking to Marcus de Sautoy, the two of them guiding us through the tragic tale of Évariste Galois. If you want to explore more of Marcus's writings, then do check out his latest book, The Creativity Code, which looks at the fascinating interplay between human creativity and computer algorithms. If you enjoyed today and would like to browse through more of our adventures into the past, then please do visit our website at tttpodcast.com, where you'll find our entire library. We've also, at long last, started our Twitter account. So if you've any thoughts on the episodes, any ideas for future guests, or you just want to say hello, then there's a new place to go. You can follow us at @TTTpodcast _. Next Tuesday, Peter will be off to the year 1871 with the Zimbabwean novelist Pitina Gapa, looking at David Livingstone's last expedition in southern Africa through the eyes of those heroic companions that made it possible. Here's an extract.
Exactly, you know, it's like that trivial pursuit question, who was the first man to ascend the summit of Everest? Mm. And, you know, the early answers would be Sir Edmund Hillary. And Tenzing would never be mentioned, you know, would never be mentioned as the Sherpa who got him there. But that's exactly what expedition life was like in pre-colonial Africa. You needed to traverse huge distances. Mm. And to do that successfully, you needed to have the assistance of porters. You know, in the Swahili, they call them the pagazi. You know, you are porters. And also sometimes soldiers who are called askari. Because sometimes there were battles to be fought. You know, hostile groups would be overcome. And there was a lot of work involved in expedition life. So many of these explorers will travel with up to, I think Stanley traveled with about 100 people.
We hope you'll join us for that next Tuesday. For us today, that's it. Goodbye.